Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello and welcome to Nature Now for the third week of June on what is probably the hottest week of 2018. I'm your host, Paul Rubin. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Aaron Ryan Punquela, Ecosystem Recovery Coordinator of the Hood Canal Strait in North Olympic Peninsula with the Puget Sound Partnership. Thank you for joining us today, Aaron.
Thanks for having me, Paul. I'm really happy to be here and excited to have an excuse to come out to the peninsula.
We're very happy to have you today, too. Can you give our listeners a short summary of your background and what makes the Puget Sound Partnership so unique?
My background is in education and environmental science. I worked with a community college and anthropology field program called the Learn and Serve Environmental Anthropology Field School, where we worked with a lot of different partners, city, counties, local tribes, nonprofits. That led me to have more of an interest in policy, which is what the Puget Sound Partnership is also a part of. And the Puget Sound Partnership is the state agency that is geared to lead the recovery of Puget Sound. And we do that in collaboration with hundreds of different partners and thousands of projects, many of which have been completed and many of which use innovative technology and approaches.
So before we get into our conversation with Aaron, we're going to just go into our mystery sound real quick. This spring migrant has an unmistakable glow and casual flicking flight pattern. Males sing along, variable series of twitters and warbles that can be several seconds long. The notes and phrases repeat in a seemingly random order. This bird's most common call is its contact call, often given in flight. It sounds like a bird quietly saying, "Put a touch hip," with a very even cadence. Birds sometimes give harsh threat calls when in feeding flocks or at the nest. Males make a tee courtship call upon landing near a female in spring or early summer, often followed by a burst of song, which I've witnessed on a few occasions. Females brooding nestlings make a rapid sequence of high notes when they hear their mate approaching with food. Birds at their nest also make a loud two-parted baby call if they feel threatened. For observation and news, summer is just around the corner as we approach the summer solstice on Thursday, June 21st. In Port Townsend, we will be experiencing 16 hours and 3 minutes of daylight all week. Morning people rejoice as you wake up to the sunrise at 5:10 a.m. Try not to burn yourself out, though, either, since it's easy to plan too many projects with so much extra time.
Surpassing a mark set during the peak of the Dust Bowl in 1934, the continental U.S. just had its hottest May on record, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced on Wednesday. Of the areas experiencing unusually warm weather, the Puget Sound region was at the top of the list. Seattle also documented record-breaking heat and dryness throughout the month of May.
Antarctica's glaciers are retreating 3 times faster than previously recorded, according to the Seattle Times. The situation is worst in West Antarctica, something that has been widely known and that the new research confirms. The enormous Thwaites Glacier, which has the potential to unlock several meters of sea level rise if it retreats entirely into the center of West Antarctica, was found to be retreating at 300 to 400 meters per year along a 25-mile central section of the glacier, according to the Washington Post. The number of new glaciers forming in eastern Antarctica has not been enough to account for western retreat. Locally, we have experienced glacier retreat in iconic areas such as Mount Rainier, Mount Anderson in the Olympics, and the Cascades.
Can Olympia oysters make a comeback in Quilcene Bay? According to the Port Townsend Leader, many people in this area believe that conditions are just right. On May 16th, volunteers gathered to make light work of an ambitious survey to locate what remnants there are of Olympia oysters in Quilcene Bay. Environmental biologist Neil Harrington told the Leader that the group found significant wild species. Cheryl Lowe, a coordinator with the Marine Resource Committee, also expressed optimism.
All right, Aaron, so for the health of the sound, how and why did the Puget Sound Partnership become established?
Well, Paul, that is a big question. There's probably a very long version and then a short version, and I might try to give you little elements of both. The Puget Sound Partnership, in short, was created by the state legislature in 2007 under Governor Christine Gregoire, and we were called to oversee the cleanup of Puget Sound. Really, before, there was never a single entity or agency that looked specifically at the Puget Sound for making sure that all the services that it provides, all of the different diverse stakeholders, were being accounted for and being protected and, at that point in time, being recovered. Throughout the 20th century, as more people moved to this area, there were new industries that were brought in, so from logging to fisheries, among many others. And as these different industries came in, there started to be lots of unintended consequences environmentally over the course of those 100 years. And in the Puget Sound, it was especially compact. So you had foresters and fishermen and lots of different people and shellfish. So throughout the 20th century, the use of our natural resources and the use of our landscape started to come to a head with other essential ecosystem services like clean air and clean water and a safe place to live. Federally, there was the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, but it just wasn't enough over time to deal with the amount of pressures that were occurring in Puget Sound. In 1999, the Chinook salmon were listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. In the early 2000s, we had Hood Canal oxygen levels that were plummeting and triggering large fish kills and other death of marine life. In 2005, the southern resident orca whale was listed on the Endangered Species Act. As a result, there was a big need to coordinate the efforts of all of the partners that were making strides to make that recovery and protect the environment, not just for the critters, but for people and all the diverse uses that we have for these resources. And so that was really the beginning of the Puget Sound Partnership.
It's kind of a headwind of events that were just required to be addressed with some organization. So I'd like to talk about the 6 defined original goals by the partnership, which include creating a healthy human population, vibrant quality of life, thriving species and food web, abundant water quantity, health water quality, and to protect and restore habitat. Those are some big goals. As ecosystem recovery coordinator, how is the ecosystem health now compared to the implementation of action 10 years ago?
That's a great question. So those 6 goals were set by the Washington legislature as part of the governing statute for the partnership itself. And what the partnership has done is take all of those goals that you just listed and divide them out into specific components of our environment that we want to focus on so that we can develop specific strategies that we know will work in protecting or recovering those. So under healthy water quality, for example, you have freshwater quality, marine sediment quality, toxics in fish, and then under habitat, eelgrass, estuaries, floodplains, and others, but also a whole other component that is just as important when we think about ecosystem recovery, and that is the relationship to the human element. So sense of place, good governance, economic vitality, as well as air quality, drinking water, local foods, and outdoor activity are all really important components to that. So those goals, that's where we're trying to get. We're trying to get to the recovery and the protection of those specific ecosystem components that support all of us to have a healthy living and vibrant quality of life. How we choose to reach those goals is through what we call the action agenda. And the action agenda is a set of strategies, their priorities, and it's really that course of how we're going to address those ongoing pressures that are affecting those vital signs and those goals that you just listed. And in order to create that action agenda, we believe that we need a collaborative effort to determine what does work and where. And so it's something that you can't create just with a few people. It's something that requires the entire community of Puget Sound to get behind and share their expertise and their knowledge so that we can reach goals and have effective strategies that work for everyone.
Very well said. Concerning the water quality index, the status is currently below the 2020 target and progress is not improving. What are some of the major contributors to poor water quality?
Yeah, that's true. So water quality, the number one I would say is stormwater. And out here in Port Townsend and Sequim and Port Angeles and the counties, Clallam County, Jefferson County, Mason County, it's a little bit different because stormwater isn't as big of a pressure as you would say in Tacoma or Olympia or Seattle.
More urban.
Yeah, it's a more urban environment. And so it's a little bit different out here when it comes to water quality. But overall, with the Puget Sound, I would say it would be stormwater. And so that is all of the rain that comes down and washes onto the roadways and the concrete and places where it's going to be washed into pipes, collects everything that's on those roadways and concrete. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that we filter that water as naturally as possible so that it doesn't affect our water quality. Out here in this area, another component of water quality would not just be the toxics and the pollution that's in the water, but also the temperature of the water and the amount of sediment that's in the water. Mm-hmm. And so in more rural areas, like out here, it's important to have native plants that are covering streams and riverways to make sure that the water is kept cool so that there's not a lot of erosion and sediment that gets into our rivers and streams.
Yeah, less anoxic conditions and algal blooms, and I think we're all familiar with that. You know, Anderson Lake, which is local lake right up here, we all know that every now and then this time of year we're going to have some issues with water quality and or nutrients, excess nitrogen.
Right, and agricultural practices, making sure that there are best management practices with what's also just as important, which is our food systems on land and how we can best
keep the runoff down, right?
Yeah, so that we reduce the high levels of nutrients that are getting into our waterways that can cause algal blooms and then these conditions that don't have any oxygen, and so that will produce fish kills and such like that.
Yeah, and then there's other things such as septic systems failing, and at least on-site septic systems, more rural areas here, that's something we might face.
Right, and there have been a lot of great projects in this area, in Clallam and Mason, which are called our PIC programs, so pollution identification and correction programs that the partnership supports, and that's getting to similar things that you're describing there, where do we have these point sources of pollution coming out? A lot of the times it's related to really old septic systems. How do we go and identify those and help folks to correct or improve or maintain those septic systems?
It affects industry like oyster industry and just recreational industry. So it's a pretty important thing out here. Is there anything we've learned since the beginning? Is there anything that's been like the takeaway, like things that have changed between like what didn't work and now we kind of figured it out? We're on the path to understanding.
What the partnership really does, we are all about learning. We have a method where we say, okay, we're going to chart the course and then we are going to implement those strategies. And as we do that, we're going to see, is this working? Is this not working? Let's evaluate how we're doing. And then let's change and adapt based off of what we've learned. And over the past 10 years, the partnership ultimately has really learned how to build this boat that we are now trying to navigate in collaboration with all of the partners that we have around the region. We're a fairly young agency, about 10 years old. And so it's really been a learning process in and of itself to come to the point that we are at here and now and incorporating all of the partners that we have. Every 2 years, the partnership researches and produces a document for the legislature called the State of the Sound, and you can find that on our website, and I also brought a few copies into the studio. And one of the key topics in each iteration is to answer that question, what have we learned? So there's a lot of technical and scientific advances. In particular, one of the things that I've looked at is green infrastructure. Where are the ways that we can now, as we get more people coming into the area, how can we build in a way that understands ecosystem health and caters to that, as well as that population growth? And low-impact development and green infrastructure philosophies can help us do that. There's a lot more in the State of the Sound, and you can read it on our website. But the main message would be that the Puget Sound ecosystem is complex and that really it's going to take all of us to make a difference.
Oh, yeah. rather than individual health, it's a community health. You know,
right.
Those little things you don't really notice all the time that really makes a strong community. It's no different than an ecosystem. You take out one or two pieces and the whole thing starts to fail in some ways. And the mm-hmm. marine ecosystem is very susceptible to that, especially with human action. And as we start to disperse over more and more land, just how we impact that land and things we can do in our own lives to reduce it at the very least.
I agree, and being really intentional, and I think that over all of the years that lead up to where we are today, we've learned an incredible amount, but we also have a lot of new issues mm-hmm. that we have never had to deal with before.
Yeah.
And so looking at how we can create systems that aren't just protecting and recovering, but are going to be resilient, so they'll be able to address some of those emerging issues and the ones that we currently have in a way that they can rebound.
We've referred to the 2017 State of the Sound a lot, and it really is a great document, and your website's awesome. You know, I've navigated through it to see some...
There's a lot there.
...data, and there's a lot of data. Do you have any outstanding examples of a recovery project? They're in this, but if you want to just bring up one or two.
The very question of what the partnership is working on in this area is a great question to better understand what we do. What the partnership does is support and advocate for a lot of the work that's already ongoing or that's addressing the specific strategies and priorities that we collectively have identified in charting the course for recovery. And so here, along the Strait and Hood Canal, there are organizations where really we help to set the table of people coming there and saying, this is what works, this is what doesn't work, this is what we need to do to remove our hard armoring and improve habitat for our little fish that feed the salmon. And those organizations are called local integrating organizations. Right now, there's 9 of them across the Puget Sound, and they really look at strategizing and prioritizing what work needs to be done. And they work with the salmon recovery counterparts that do the same thing, but is specifically for salmon recovery, called our lead entities.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I try to do is help support those organizations that already have incredible groups, marine resource committees, the counties, the land trusts, the salmon enhancement groups, tribes, and so many other folks that have the knowledge and the expertise in this local area. Right now, the Dungeness Floodplain Restoration is an incredible project that's ongoing. The PIC programs that I mentioned before, Pollution Identification and Correction Programs, are a fantastic program. There are hundreds, and you can find those online or contact the local integrating or lead entity organization in this area.
Yeah, so you're the coordinator in the pure form. You really coordinate mm-hmm. all the local organizations to get something done.
I work with the coordinator that does do that
I
work.
See.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So for each LIO, there is a coordinator, and they really have that local expertise in bringing
yeah.
those folks together.
Good.
And I'll help to support them.
Great. I guess there's one thing that I wanted to just bring up. You mentioned shoreline armoring,
mm-hmm.
and it's a term I hear every now and then, but from someone like you, I'm curious to hear, like, what is that? And some people might know, but you know, if you want to just describe it briefly.
Yeah, shoreline armoring is really, you look along the shorelines, along our beaches, and sometimes you see a beach that looks really short, and it looks like there's a wall right
mm-hmm.
right in the back there. And that wall is a hard wall.
Mm-hmm.
And what that has done, it has shortened the beach, and so the natural way of sediment to flow up
mm-hmm.
and down that beach corridor does not function as it has in the past. And by doing so, you remove a lot of this different specific types of sediment qualities that are needed for good habitat for the baby fish, so for forage fish like herring, to come and lay their eggs and then reproduce in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so shoreline armoring is not the most effective way to build a healthy shoreline itself. So what we encourage folks to look at is find opportunities to remove that hard armoring and put in armoring that will also protect that shoreline,
mm-hmm.
but also make it constructive for the ecosystem to do what it wants to do and to produce a healthy food web. Soft armoring techniques is what those are called.
I think that's a great example of some of the work you do. I think that's going to wrap up our conversation. We're going to go back into our mystery sound revealed. boasting black wings and a cap with a vibrant golden body, American goldfinches are a mainstay in our area right now. I tuned in last week to a female calling endlessly to her mate. She switched between three perches, calling and calling with no success. I felt sad as I had seen the pair flying happily around the orchard the day before, with thoughts of her mate being plucked by a predator after their journey north. Luckily, after an hour or so, I observed her with not one but two males, perhaps a former nestling or competing mate. Some interesting facts. American goldfinches breed later than most North American birds. They wait to nest until June or July, when milkweed, thistle, and other plants have produced their fibrous seeds, which goldfinches incorporate into their nests and feed their young. Goldfinches are among the strictest vegetarians in the bird world, selecting an entirely vegetable diet and only inadvertently swallowing an occasional insect. When brown-headed cowbirds lay eggs in an American goldfinch nest, the cowbird egg may hatch, but the nestling seldom survives longer than 3 days. The cowbird chick simply cannot survive on an all-seed diet that goldfinches feed their young. Thank you to Cornell Lab of Ornithology, Macaulay Library, and AllAboutBirds.com for sound recordings and descriptions. For upcoming events, Aaron, would you like to start us off?
Sure. Have you ever wanted to become a fish passage technician? Well, here's your opportunity. The North Olympic Salmon Coalition is surveying Hoco River, Clallam Bay, to assess stream habitat and measure culverts for fish passability. Enjoy this beautiful weather while wading through streams. Disclaimer, there may be some brush to trudge through in driving from site to site. Surveying dates are throughout the months of June, July, and August. Contact Program Assistant Olivia Vito for more information.
Join the Dungeness River Audubon Center for a Flowers of the Peninsula walk at Hurricane Hill. John Bridge will lead four classes to look at flowers from low-elevation riparian forests and up to an alpine area. The event will start with fawn lilies at the meeting of the Dungeness River and Grey Wolf River and finish up with glacier lilies, grass widows, and many more that cover the alpine slopes. Participants will walk between 2 and 4 miles each day. Make sure to have time to smell the flowers and take photos. Call 360-681-4076 or email rceducation@olympus.net for more information. I want to thank our guest, Aaron Ryan Panuela, the Ecosystem Recovery Coordinator of the Hood Canal Strait and North Olympic Peninsula.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
And thank you for listening to another episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we all live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Puget Sound, performed by Donato Wharton.